You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Boys and Their Toys. Inside the hyper-macho, Bible-thumping alt-tech universe, trying to take on Silicon Valley. From El Segundo, by Zoe Bernard. For more than 2 years, in the small, unassuming beach town of El Segundo, California, dozens of young men have gathered with a singular mission: to save America. They will do this, they say, by building the next generation of great tech companies. They call what they are building real shit, not like what the software engineers make up north, writing code on shiny MacBooks. Instead, these men have a taste for the tangible. They spend their work days toiling in labs and manufacturing lines, their nights sleeping on couches and bunk beds. Some are making drones to try to control the weather. Others are building nuclear reactors and military weaponry designed to fight Russia and China. Out in El Segundo, where the saltwater-tinged air thrums with steady plane traffic and oil refineries sweep across the shoreline, these founders see themselves as faithful foot soldiers of American industry, as well as bold incubators upending Silicon Valley's status quo. "We're pollinating different ideas," Augusta Storico, the founder and CEO of the cloud seeding company Rainmaker, which raised $6.3 million from venture capitalists in May, tells me. "We're sick of nihilism and goofy software products." Behind him, on Rainmaker's office wall, hangs an American flag the size of a dumpster. Opposite is a life-size poster of Jesus Christ, smiling benevolently onto a bench press below. "Right now," he adds, "Gundo is for hard tech what Florence was for art during the Renaissance." For decades, cities across America have aspired to assume Silicon Valley's mantle as the next technological hotbed. It was rumored for a short while that the entrepreneurial epicenter had shifted to Austin and then Miami. When it comes to the Gundo, the technological zeitgeist is, like all of these places, fueled by venture capitalists who have invested more than $100 billion in defense tech companies since 2021, many of which are located in El Segundo. But the founders are adamant that their city, despite its investment windfall, is not Silicon Valley's next act. In fact, it is ideologically opposed to what they consider the soft and comfortable world of the Bay Area and the lightweight commodities it now largely produces: corporate subscription software and trivial consumer applications. This is not San Francisco Light, or San Francisco plus a little bit of hardware, says Zane Mountcastle, CEO of the defense technology company PicoGrid. "It's a different world from San Francisco, and it has a completely different mindset." Despite its proximity to Los Angeles, El Segundo is a factory town with a laid-back temperament. The city is home to fewer than 20,000 people and has deep manufacturing roots. Nearly three-quarters of its land is dedicated to industrial uses, including petroleum refineries, power plants, and aerospace manufacturers. It is imbued with Californian nostalgia. Patrons sip beer on bar patios alongside their dogs. Below billowing steam towers, the downtown streets are flanked with retro diners and vintage record shops. The founders in El Segundo have settled on an expansive terrain from which to express sentiments that might chafe progressive sensibilities. They have an outsized respect for their country and men in uniform. They love fast cars, tobacco products, and their Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. They are aspirationally blue-collar. Often wearing blue jeans, clean leather work boots, and dark T-shirts with company emblems embroidered on their breast pocket. At the offices of the nuclear energy company Valor Atomics, where I was invited to attend a Bible study, Bibles were propped up on desk beside laptops. Valor Atomics head of business operations, Elijah Froh, who is 26 years old and has the straightforward self-assurance of a car salesman, offered me a glass of raw milk, increasingly the drink of choice in many conservative circles. Then he led our small group in prayer and read aloud a passage from Hebrews. Later, Froh invited me into Valor Atomics' cigar lounge, where actual cigars can't be smoked due to a permitting issue with the building. We sat in enormous leather armchairs beside a small table stacked with cigars sealed in Ziploc bags. On the wall hung four large classical paintings depicting Columbus discovering America, the pilgrims arriving on the Mayflower, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitutional Convention. Froh told me that God needed businessmen just as much as he needed missionaries, and that God had put him on this earth to build a nuclear energy company. During the 3 days that I visited companies in the Gundo, I saw three women and spoke to one, the wife of an employee at Valor Atomics, who attended the Bible study along with her two young children. She had moved to a house near the beach with her husband 3 weeks earlier. When I asked if she was meeting many nice people, she laughed and said that she was too busy taking care of her children to leave the house. Later, I asked a founder in the Gundo why he thought there were so few women. "You're missing the point," he told me, claiming that this line of inquiry is a non-thing. It muddles the story, and it distracts from our core mission of trying to save the West. "Just about every company in the Gundo has a huge American flag in its office, but the biggest, an object of envy among all the Gundo founders, is on the wall of Olaf Hichwa and Soren Munro Anderson's 15,000-square-foot drone factory near us. Hichwa is a wide-eyed, toothy 22-year-old from the D.C. area. In May, Neros raised nearly $11 million. In the Neros factory, Hichwa showcased his company's product, a wickedly fast drone that he maneuvered to terrifying heights above my head. Later, he showed me a video of Ukrainian soldiers detonating a bomb latched to a Neros drone on Russian artillery. The war in Ukraine has both legitimized and popularized the efforts of many founders in the defense tech industry, especially Palmer Luckey, the founder of Anduril. The Gundo founders speak of Luckey often and reverentially. In 2017, Luckey left Facebook. He has said he was fired for supporting Donald Trump. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg denied that politics was a factor in Luckey's departure. Today, he is vindicated. His company has been awarded multiple lucrative military contracts. This year, it is seeking a $12.5 billion valuation. Politically, Luckey is hardly a rarity. In recent weeks, many of Silicon Valley's most influential venture capitalists have rallied behind the former president, including Marc Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, Sequoia partner Sean McGuire, and All In podcast host David Sacks and Chamath Palihapitiya. Sacks and Palihapitiya were reportedly both instrumental in helping Trump pick J.D. Vance, who had a stint in venture capital, as his running mate. It is felt that Trump is an essential player in Silicon Valley's investments in defense tech. But during my conversations in El Segundo, Trump came up only twice. When I asked Froh if he supported Trump in the 2020 election, he told me he couldn't remember who he voted for. Phil Ehrenstein, the voluble and charismatic founder and CEO of Dirac, an anti-software company that generates assembly instructions for industrial manufacturers, told me that Trump was early to the idea that China would someday figure as the United States' greatest threat. Like many of the Gundo founders, the threat of the Great Red Dragon weighs heavy on Ehrenstein's mind. China wants to see the West and our way of life and democracy collapse, he says. The El Segundo founders live in a world in which military might is a moral obligation rather than a national necessity. Having an adversary is very interesting, says Ehrenstein, because it gets people to work harder. Sometimes it seems that the El Segundo founders are acting out a studied caricature of nostalgic Americana, especially on X. At least some part of the scene is pure performance. It's totally intentional. You have to make it cool, says Cameron Schiller, the co-founder and CEO of the aerospace manufacturer Rangeview. We're trying to bring more young people into manufacturing. Schiller is tall and lean, with the good looks of a Hollister model. He tricked out his office with a set of concert speakers, purple and orange mood lighting, a jet engine, and a race car simulator. The founders occasionally have private discussions about whether they are posting too much on X. We don't want this to be a fad, says Ehrenstein. When I tell Isaiah Taylor, the 25-year-old founder of Valor Atomics, that the Gundo scene seems a little contrived, he shrugs. Maybe we just really like America, he says. In the Gundo, patriotism is theatrical, but it is not theater. For me, being patriotic is like asking me if I love my mom. I don't know why we in the U.S. have such a hard time with that. The tobacco products, the bench pressing, the jumbo-size American flags, the devotion to God and country, all would be happening, he tells me, whether or not there's a spotlight on us. party planning. Putin wants Trump to win, of course, and he's got big ideas about a new world order. Think Yalta on Fiji. By Mikhail Zygar. Opening illustration by Mark Harris shows Trump seated between the Russian leader and the Chinese leader. I don't know which moment in U.S. history former President Donald Trump imagines when he says, "Make America Great Again." He has never given a definitive answer in any speech or interview. But I know exactly which moment Vladimir Putin imagines in his own vision for Russian greatness. It is February 1945, when Joseph Stalin, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill divided the world in Crimea. 3 months remained before the surrender of Nazi Germany, but it was clear the Allies were winning. To determine what the world would look like after the defeat of the Third Reich, the Soviet Premier, U.S. President, and British Prime Minister went to the city of Yalta, a resort area on the Black Sea. Stalin achieved everything he wanted. He convinced his then allies that he should have his own sphere of influence, which included all of Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, and what were then Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia. The leaders also devised the United Nations Security Council, on which they secured permanent seats for their countries. This structure existed for the next 45 years, de facto collapsing along with the Soviet Union. Putin once called the breakup of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Throughout his presidency, Putin has said the world needs a new Yalta. If the old world order no longer works, a new one must be invented. He began talking about this in 2007 during his famous Munich speech, in which he challenged the U.S.-dominated unipolar world order for the first time, and has repeated the proposal many times since, including in his speech at the UN in 2015, in Davos in 2021, and in his addresses to the Russian parliament almost every year. But for a new Yalta, Putin needs suitable partners, including a U.S. president who would agree to divide the world with him. Since Soviet times, there has been a stereotype in the Kremlin. It is easier to negotiate with Republicans than with Democrats. This stems from the détente between the USSR and the U.S. during the administrations of Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. Jimmy Carter, the thinking goes, paid too much attention to human rights. Kremlin officials still believe that Republicans are constructive partners, while Democrats are hypocrites posing as saints. At first, Putin considered George W. Bush a suitable partner. After all, Bush even looked the man in his eye and was able to get a sense of his soul. But after 2004, when the U.S. supported the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and other color revolutions in the former USSR, Putin began to fear that Bush wanted to overthrow him, too. Moreover, the Kremlin sincerely believed that Bush wanted to become the military dictator of the world. Putin was astonished when, after Hurricane Katrina, Bush's ratings plummeted, and he did not cling to power, did not attempt to change the Constitution, did not seek a third term, the things Putin himself would be ready to do for power. Putin never trusted Barack Obama. He always believed that when American politicians talked about values, it was all hypocrisy, masking some cunning, inevitably anti-Russian plans. In 2013, Putin watched the fictional series House of Cards and took it as proof that he was right. All his expectations and fears were confirmed. Indeed, American politicians were cynical, cruel, and deceitful. He just needed to wait for the right person to come to power. Back in 2011 and 2012, Putin believed that the mass protest against his third term were organized and funded by the State Department under Hillary Clinton. Therefore, in 2016, he had no doubts. He saw the Democratic presidential candidate as a personal enemy. From the moment Trump was elected, the word Yalta became one of the most popular among Kremlin officials. They were confident Trump was the right person to agree to such a spectacle. This did not mean Russian authorities considered Trump their puppet. The Kremlin never had any means to influence him. Putin simply believed Trump was morally close and understandable to him. A fellow cynic who also thought that money solved everything. But the scandal over Russian interference in U.S. elections ruined all these plans. No rapprochement occurred. Aside from a few brief meetings during global summits, Putin and Trump held only one full-fledged negotiation in Helsinki in 2018. But now, the Kremlin believes that if Trump wins re-election in November, everything will be different. It hopes he will no longer pay attention to the liberal media or the criticism of the Democrats. Furthermore, the Kremlin is certain Trump is ready, at least rhetorically, to dismantle the old world order and claim credit for creating a new one. The fantasies of Kremlin strategists have developed like this. A new Yalta conference with Putin and Trump might not necessarily take place in Crimea. For greater symbolism, somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, roughly equidistant from Russia and the U.S., would be more suitable. My sources in Moscow, who wish to remain anonymous for security reasons, suggest that such a summit could look good on Fiji. Putin's entourage understands that despite his ambitions, he is not like Stalin in 1945, and today's Russia is no match for the Soviet Union. Therefore, the dreams of the current Kremlin inhabitants suggest that another participant in the new Big Three should be China, represented by Xi Jinping. They believe that the real Cold War is beginning between China and the U.S., so the upcoming Yalta-Fiji should formulate the rules of this confrontation. And Putin is ready to be content with the role of the third partner, a kind of modern-day Churchill. Of course, he wants to secure his place on the global board of directors, that is the UN Security Council, and expects to be allotted his sphere of influence, the countries of the former Soviet Union. While fantasizing about the future of the U.S. under Trump, the Kremlin harbors another dream. It sees it as the ultimate revenge for the Cold War defeat and the fall of the USSR. Putin's current advisors are confident the U.S. will eventually disintegrate, breaking into several pieces like the Soviet Union ultimately did. This would require the right conditions and a leader who could plunge the country into chaos. You might be surprised, but the nickname used for Trump in the Kremlin is the American Gorbachev. For them, Mikhail Gorbachev was not a Democrat or a reformer. For former KGB officers, Gorbachev was a demagogue and a narcissist who desperately wanted to please the audience, but had no plan of action. A president whose policies were so chaotic that the empire began to collapse, with different parts declaring their independence. This is wishful thinking, but Putin's inner circle would like to believe Trump could become just such a president. Moreover, since American cinema is an important source of information and inspiration for Putin's analyst, they have already received the necessary confirmation from Hollywood. Civil War, starring Kirsten Dunst, is evidence to them that the situation in the U.S. is worsening by the day. The disaster film is treated as almost a prophecy. They are therefore convinced they are on the right track. just a little more, and Trump will agree to a new Yalta. And then the U.S. will disintegrate, and Russia will win the new Cold War. Vladimir Putin believes that his dream is not so unattainable. Stranger Things, The Democrats' Short Hot Summer of Weird, by Case Wickman. Opening illustration shows the faces of Trump, J.D. Vance, and Ted Cruz, hands wagging, superimposed with a backdrop of smiley face emojis with googly eyes, laughing with tears coming out of their eyes, and mouths, mouths, and more mouths, disembodied and yakking. The 2024 presidential election is shaping up to be the weirdest in history. Just ask Democratic political operatives. The party of "they go low, we go high" has asterisked that slogan. This year, "they go low, we go side-eye." Yes, the left's latest talking point has emerged, and it's passive-aggressive and petty as hell. Those Republicans are straight-up weird. On July 25th, the campaign for Kamala Harris, whose brand-new presidential bid was off to a running start, said the quiet thing loud in a press release reacting to an interview Republican nominee Donald Trump gave to Fox News. Trump is old and quite weird. This was just one of the takeaways in the release titled Statement on a 78-Year-Old Criminal's Fox News Appearance. Pointing out Trump's erratic and flustered behavior and positing that when Trump wasn't lying, he was making threats. Another bullet point read, this guy shouldn't be president ever again. Harris has been beating the weird drum since at least 2018, when CNN reported she was confronted with the idea of debating Trump in a hypothetical 2020 run. During prep, she pondered how she'd respond if Trump reprised how he had behaved during his debate with Hillary Clinton in 2016, stalking back and forth and lurking over her shoulder. Harris said she'd simply turn around and ask him, why are you being so weird? It's now the Democrats' jibe of choice toward the opposition. Jesse Lee, a former senior official in the Obama-Biden White House, tells Vanity Fair that the revived messaging matches the candidate. There's definitely more of an energetic and kind of feisty attitude, Lee says of Harris's aura, compared with President Joe Biden's. I think it's a smart recognition that part of how people vote, understandably, is kind of personality and just overall headspace. They don't know every single detail of every single policy, but they have a sense of people. When you look at somebody like J.D. Vance, once the weirdness gets into the bloodstream and gets into the ether, everything sort of starts to feed into it. You start to see it everywhere you look. And that's really the most effective kind of narrative and framing you could do, where it takes on a life of its own and people start to see things through that lens. Given the quick pivot the campaign made to embracing internet culture like Charlie XCX's anointment of Kamala is brat, it's no surprise that the party has shifted to mirror Harris's take-no-shit realness, too. Harris's campaign and surrogates have effectively made the entire GOP a meme, with creators like Minnesota governor-turned-VP pick Tim Walz gleefully lampooning the right's VIPs in the press. These are weird people on the other side. They want to take books away. They want to be in your exam room, he said of Republicans during a recent MSNBC interview. That's what it comes down to. And don't get sugarcoating this. These are weird ideas. It's in the framing. Banning abortion and limiting the messages doctors can share with patients sound like insurmountable policy issues that little old me wouldn't be able to impact. These guys being in your exam room? Weird. I'm telling you, these guys are weird, Walz posted alongside a clip of his appearance. According to Democratic strategist Caitlin Ligocki, a former Biden administration communications official, the message coming out of Walz's mouth is effective because it cast him as the straight man foil to the GOP's drunk uncle at the Thanksgiving table. He looks like a normal guy, she says of Walz. Just the ability for someone like him to kind of endorse that idea and say, like, this is not normal behavior. These are not normal people. Really added fuel to that fire. It's fitting that to compete against a former reality TV star, the Democrats have invoked the villain edit, highlighting the most outlandish and indefensible moments of the other side. In a New York Times op-ed in March, Primary Colors author Joe Klein argued that Democrats need to stop playing nice, calling Democrats the party of identity politics, always sensitive to insensitivity, often to a fault. Well, look at Harris on top of the ticket. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Though, as Lee points out, calling somebody weird, saying they're a little bit weird, is not the meanest thing I've ever heard. I'm not sure I would put that in the gloves are off category. The big weirdo theory isn't new news. It's a strategy based on decades of bad vibes. Media Matters Deputy Director of Rapid Response, Andrew Lawrence, has long held the opinion that Republicans are weird freaks and has peppered the phrase through his post. While he says he feels a little vindicated, he also notes that mockery is such an effective tool against these people. Here's Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear after Vance commented it was very weird that Beshear's first job was at his dad's law office and that he inherited the governorship from his father. What was weird was Vance joking about racism today and then talking about Diet Mountain Dew, Beshear told CNN. Who drinks Diet Mountain Dew? Then there's Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker side-eyeing Vance's criticism of Harris for having no biological children. The vice presidential candidate for the Republicans is insulting women who own cats. He has a weird view of America, honestly, he said on CNN. In the same way, someone calling your potato salad recipe interesting will forever live rent-free in your mind. These little jabs make a person doubt the basic humanity of those in the running to run the country. Even Republican cheerleader Senator Mitch McConnell despairs over his party's increasing weirdness. In 2022, explaining away the GOP's midterm election performance, he basically said, "What can you do?" My view was, do the best you can with the cards you're dealt, he said of his fellow Republicans. Now, hopefully, in the next cycle, we'll have quality candidates everywhere and a better outcome. No one is immune, no matter their political affiliation. Former President George W. Bush was ahead of the curve in dubbing Trump and his cohort weirdos. Officially, he attended Trump's presidential inauguration in January 2017. Unofficially, he reportedly turned to his companions as they left the dais and said, "That was some weird shit." Internet culture isn't the only thing inspiring Harris's campaign. Modern dating parlance offers the idea of the ick, defined by the Cambridge Dictionary as a sudden feeling that you dislike someone or something, or are no longer attracted to someone because of something they do. Once you get the ick, you can't un-ick, ever. In dating, that might mean losing someone's number. In politics, the Democrats are hoping that voters' ick will translate at the polls. Of course, the unified theory of ick, politics edition, is nonpartisan, as evidenced by a severe case of the ick following Biden's presidential debate performance. As Lawrence points out, if you're making an attack and then there's something that happens that reinforces that, it's really hard to get away from it. The Biden debate, going into it, Republicans said, "He's old, he's old, he's old." And then he looked old. You can't get that out of people's heads. Again, it goes both ways. And so you have Democrats saying they're weird freaks, they're weird freaks, they're weird freaks. And then old clips of J.D. Vance come out talking about cat ladies. Donald Trump talking about Hannibal Lecter like he's a real person. All of that stuff just kind of builds on itself until it becomes a part of the zeitgeist. Progressive voters are noticing this linguistic shift, and they're on board. One person on X wondered why anyone at all would vote for a Republican. Hateful, cruel, misogynistic, and like vibey in a weird, unsettling way, they wrote. Ligaki underlines that while voters may disagree with one another on points at the policy level, there's room for unity under the banner of pettiness. It allows for everyone to have their own preferences and beliefs, but it underscores this idea that Republicans have become so focused on telling other people what they can and cannot do in their own homes that it's overshadowed every other thing that they claim to believe in, she says. Surely, now that we're firmly in the era of if you see weird, say something, the Democratic faithful cheered when Senator Ted Cruz popped up on Fox News and said, Kamala can't have my guns. She can't have my gasoline engine. And she sure as hell can't have my steaks and cheeseburgers. Kamala Harris is not asking for your gently used ground meats, sir. Don't be so weird. This is the issue's cover story, Both Sides Now. Selena Gomez is seriously in love and making the best work of her career. With the audacious Emilia Perez hitting theaters and only Murders in the Building returning to TV, the actor, singer, entrepreneur, and mental health advocate talks about the climb. By Johanna Desta. With photos by Emma Summerton. Styled by Dina Giannini. rare vintage. Selena Gomez photographed in Los Angeles on July 29th with classic Hollywood in mind. And dressed appropriately, fashionably. Her speaking voice is a famously soothing low hum. To say it's unmistakable would be putting it mildly. You try going incognito, sounding like Selena Gomez. Yeah, it doesn't work, she tells me. Literally, one time I was in line for something. I was fully in disguise, and I was talking to someone. I don't even remember what I said. And then the woman in front of me goes, "My God, it is you. I thought I heard your voice." That was years ago. I was like, "Oh God, what do I sound like to people?" And then I also feel so silly once I get busted. Gomez has long since given up on wigs and hats as cloaking devices. In the 25 years since she debuted on Barney and Friends at the age of 7, she's actually tried to let go of every kind of disguise and be the same person in public and private. It's a gutsy endeavor for someone who, thanks to Instagram, has the slightly scary-sounding distinction of being the most followed woman on Earth. For 3 years, Gomez has been part of the delicious hit series Only Murders in the Building, and she's just given the rawest performance of her career in the audacious movie musical Amelia Perez. Gomez plays a Mexican drug lord's terrified but wildly resourceful wife. When the movie hits theaters in November, her work will surprise the many, many people who didn't know what a fiery actor she could be. We first meet in Los Angeles at the makeup company she founded, Rare Beauty. It's a slow, gray afternoon, but Rare Beauty is flush with positivity. From the product names, lipsticks in shades like Worthy and Strong, eyeshadow sticks called Integrity and Well-Being, to the little slogans on the bathroom mirrors like Find Comfort in Being Rare. It's all completely in earnest, and the company's products are seriously good, as are the rewards. Rare Beauty is reportedly worth $2 billion. Gomez's office is bathed in white, pink, and red. It's a bouquet of a space. When I come in, she's surrounded by the smiling California team that keeps her carefully calibrated days as a movie star, TV star, pop star, beauty executive, and mental health advocate on track. There's a laptop on her desk, a script for Amelia Perez, and a list of questions for a famous friend she met through Taylor, whom she's interviewing for something later. There are personal mementos, too, like family photos and a note from her 11-year-old sister, Gracie. She's funny, Gomez says warmly. She picks up the note and reads it out loud. Hi, sissy. I love you so much. The next time I'm here, can we do each other's makeup and make a get ready with me TikTok? This moment totally tracks, Gomez's friend and Amelia Perez co-star Zoe Saldana tells me later. I don't fit well in circles where people only want to talk about themselves. Selena's not like that, she says. She'll show you 300 pictures of her little sister and parents and grandparents. When Gomez's team files out, she settles on a couch the color of mulled wine. She looks cozy and hale in a denim Free People jumpsuit and UGG slippers. Her skin is aglow, her hair voluminous. She is, like some other stars of her magnitude, much more slight in person, her features writ delicate. Gomez redid Rare Beauty's offices last year and shared a carousel of photos with her 425 million followers on Instagram. At the time of our interview, she's taking a break from the app, but hasn't announced it to her fans, the Selenators, because she has a habit of dramatically announcing social media breaks, then logging back on less than 24 hours later to post a selfie or leave a comment somewhere. It's one of her more aggressively relatable habits, this inability to resist the apps after boldly saying she's done with them. I learned not to say that anymore, she deadpans. Right now, she's trying to quietly enjoy her time in the analog world. I've been loving it, she says calmly, I've been working out. I've been taking care of myself. It's the first time I've had a break in a little bit, so I feel good. There's no shortage of things to feel good about. Gomez recently snagged an Emmy nomination for Best Actress in a comedy for Only Murders, her first ever acting nod, despite working steadily for 2 decades. I freaked out, she says happily. I went to dinner with my friends that night. Maybe the voters saw something in this past season that they hadn't seen before. Gomez also became the most nominated Latina producer ever in the Best Comedy category, thanks to the series. She had no idea she was about to set a record. When I heard that, I felt like I made my dad's side of the family proud, she says. It was really cool to have that be a part of my story. I'm grateful for breaking barriers. Hopefully this is not a one-time thing. Gomez's father, Ricardo Joel Gomez, is Mexican-American. He and her mother, the former actor Mandy Tiefe, whom Gomez has credited with steering her through some daunting poverty early on and inspiring her career, named her after the Tejano icon Selena and raised her in Grand Prairie, Texas. It's empowering and it's alleviating, Saldana says, of seeing Gomez make history as a Latina. When you meet her, you get the sense that she is owning her growth and owning her life and her voice. I'm grateful that our paths have crossed. The two of them met in Paris on the set of Emilia Perez, a bold, heartfelt, and visually lush Spanish-language musical that's about to have an eventful awards season of its own. The film was written and directed by Jacques Audiard. It stars Spanish actor Carla Sofia Gascon in the titular role, a brutal Mexican cartel leader who kidnaps a lawyer, Saldana, to offer her a job, coordinating secret gender confirmation surgery so the kingpin can transition and leave her old life behind. Gomez plays Jessie, Perez's dormant volcano of a wife. She's a lonely young woman and the mother of their 2 children, who's ferried from safe house to safe house in armored vehicles laden with security guards. As Emilia finds herself going down a different path in life, so does Jessie. She's emboldened to break out of her shell, with all kinds of consequences. Gomez calls Emilia Perez a fever dream, but it's not as wild a leap for her as it may appear. She's long pursued supporting roles in unconventional, sometimes risque work by auteurs, like Harmony Korine's endlessly zeitgeisty Spring Breakers, or Jim Jarmusch's zombie comedy, The Dead Don't Die. That's intentional, she tells me. I'd rather be a supporting role. I'd rather have 4 scenes in a Martin Scorsese film than be a lead in a movie about a tomboy that comes into her own and falls in love with a boy next door. Love those movies. Totally watch those movies. But that's not something I'm necessarily interested in. Odiar admits he was only faintly familiar with Gomez, having seen her in Spring Breakers and the Woody Allen film A Rainy Day in New York. But when she auditioned for Emilia Perez, he knew very quickly that he wanted to hire her. As for Gascon, she was extremely familiar with Gomez, not least because she has a 13-year-old daughter who is a superfan. There's something very special about her, Gascon says of Gomez. Needless to say, her daughter was excited about the project. She told me, you better treat her well. Gomez says she signed on to Emilia Perez largely because of Gascon, who plays the drug lord both before her transition and after, pulling off a riveting dual performance. She actually carried the whole film, and we followed her lead when it came to anything sensitive, Gomez says. She challenged me. In some of our scenes, she wasn't afraid to get in my face, and I loved it because I had to match that energy. Both Gascon and Saldana offered their services if Gomez ever needed help with the dialogue. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman. Today's broadcast is in memory of Stephen G. Rest in peace.